Hello and welcome to the Gentleman's Journal podcast, a new half-hour fortnightly discussion about success, modern business and the lives of entrepreneurs. I'm your host, Joseph Bullmore, and today's edition is all about working your way up the food chain, almost literally in fact. I'm sitting this afternoon with three men who have started at the bottom of the restaurant and hospitality industries and now find themselves at the very top. We'll be finding out how they did it, how others might do the same, and what business lessons they've learned along their journey through this famously unforgiving industry. My first guest is Robin Hudson. Robin's CV is something of a who's who of world famous hotels. He's worked at Claridge's, Stone's Chop House, the Hotel du Crayon in Paris, and of course, the Barclay, where at the age of just 23, he became the youngest ever reception manager in the Savoy Group. Very soon, Robin had founded his own venture, Hotel du Vin, otherwise known as Britain's first boutique hotel, before helping to grow the burgeoning Soho House Group as its chairman. Today, he runs homegrown hotels with chemical millionaire Jim Ratcliffe, with whom he founded of the Pigs, a litter of luxury boutique inns across the country. Thank you very much for coming to speak to us, Robin.
Hi, good afternoon.
Also here with me is Rupert Cleveley. Rupert spent 20 years as the international marketing manager at Veuve Clicquot before founding Geronimo Inns with his wife Jo back in 1995. Back then there was just one site, the Chelsea Ram in southwest London, but today there are more than 30 Geronimo pubs across the capital and beyond. Geronimo was acquired by Young & Co. in December 2010, and now Rupert's something of an angel investor and a pub consultant, helping to advise hospitality businesses from startup stage to multinational. Thank you very much for talking to us, Rupert.
Not at all. Delighted to be here.
And finally, Kurt Staser. Kurt moved from Australia to England at the age of just 12 and soon found himself a job as a pot washer in a restaurant kitchen by lying about his age. At 16, he got a job at McDonald's before becoming the youngest ever manager at Southern Fast Foods at the age of 18, handling its busiest restaurant. And then, aged just 24, Kurt was headhunted to go and work for Nobu, the stratospherically popular New York sushi restaurant. His task was to bring the chain to London at a time when no one here really ate sushi. It soon won a Michelin star. Kurt later struck out on his own with Ping Pong, and then Chotto Matte in Soho, Black Row in Mayfair, and now Fucina, a neighbourhood Italian restaurant in Marylebone.
Pleasure to be here.
So we've heard your individual kind of Wikipedia bios, I suppose, and each of them span a huge number of ventures, many famous names, lots of decades between them. How much do you think the industry has moved on since you cut your teeth in it, and how different is it now for an entrepreneur trying to start out? Robin?
Well, I think obviously the industry has gone nuts over the last few decades since we've all been involved in it. I always take it back to when we first started Hotel du Vin in '94 in Winchester. At that time, you couldn't buy an espresso on any high street in the country.
Right.
It just didn't exist. It probably existed in a few Italian coffee shops in Soho, and that was about it. But that just, I think, is a really great kind of indication of what's happened to the food and restaurant market over those relatively few years. That's only 20 years ago, and quite incredible now what's happened. Every other door on any high street is a restaurant or an eatery of some description.
And does that make it easier, that kind of change, or does that make it much more competitive and difficult for a young entrepreneur maybe in the hospitality industry?
I think the point that Robin makes is a very, very good one, exactly the same in pubs. In 95, you couldn't, when we started the Chelsea Ram, and I remember him starting the Hotel du Vin, we sponsored with Veuve Clicquot one of the bedrooms in Winchester.
He did indeed.
And in 95, all you could get in a pub was a pint of Foster's, a Young's Bitter, and you really couldn't get anything very good to eat. Mm. And you think about it now, every pub within central London is now a glorified sort of place that people call gastropubs, and you've got one just over the road here.
Yeah.
So the whole thing has changed dramatically. And how has it affected us? I think if I look at it now, because I've gone back into business, started a new pub company, we need to be so much better now than we were. And I think, in fact, we had a meeting this morning with the team. We're talking about how people are not looking for material things anymore, and the young today are not going to be able to afford material things. And what they want more and more is experiences.
Yeah.
So they want to be able to go to places like Kurt's and to Robin's and hopefully mine, and to have great experiences and to have those wonderful. So they want, for us in pubs, they want to have you know, 10 different beers or 15 different beers, and they want to have one from the little microbrewery, and they want to have one from the big brewer, and they want the interesting plate of food that they would never have got, and they expect wonderful service. So I think the whole thing has got, it's got massively more competitive.
What I've also seen, if you go back to 95, 96, that's the year that I started Nobu, in those days, I could probably count on my hand how many really, really good restaurants there were in London.
Yeah.
And today I get asked often the question, your favorite restaurant in London, where should we go? What's a good restaurant? And actually, it's so hard to even keep up with the amount of restaurants that are opening that are really good as well. And I see London as a launch pad for brands. I see if it works in London, it tends to be very successful elsewhere in the world. And also, you'd get chased down to bring your brand across over the pond and other places in the world.
Yeah.
So a lot of operators now from around the world find London the place for them to start their launch pad, if you like. But it only puts more burden on us. It's great for the consumer because now the competition is so tough, the standards are so high, that doing what you maybe did in 95 wouldn't pass today, and you get a lot of operators now that don't have a wealth of experience, but they have a lot of in operational, but they have a lot of experience traveling and eating that they can now start, you know, competing at a very good level too without the background. So, you know, with the prices, the rents, the rates, we all know what they're doing to us, and all the other things that are going on with the economy. You know, it's a tough business, and to succeed today doesn't mean to fill up every night. It means to fill up twice every night and lunchtime too.
Wow.
So we really, to make ends meet, have to make sure that we're not just successful, we're super successful, and then we make a decent return. So that's kind of where we were in 96 to where we are today, I see in the business. It's still possible. It's much more daunting. And sometimes I start to think that maybe London is a place to step back and wait and see what's going to happen in the future before investing.
You've always stayed away from it, haven't you?
Yes, we have. And you know, I guess I'm probably a little scared of London. You know, I can be a largish fish in a small pond outside London, and by being as good as we can be in a given area, you can make quite a lot of noise. So you know, that's always been our strategy. Try to get the get control, if you like, of a small area where we're the restaurant and hotel of choice. I mean, our business model is slightly different as well, because we have always paired our restaurants with hotels. So I always maintains that, you know, if we're doing it vaguely right in the restaurant, we might have 60 or 70 people sleeping above the restaurant, and if they're not eating in my restaurant, then I'm really doing something wrong. So so capturing that kind of sleeping market, if you like, above the shop has always been fundamental and to what we do.
And there's a stat that's kind of bandied around that 80% of restaurants fail in the first 3 years.
It's 90, I was told. I've always been quoting 1 in 9 survives. But that doesn't mean that you're 10 open and 9 of those 10 close. I think it just forces 9 others out.
Right.
Because, you know, there's only a certain level of people, the number of people that want to eat out every night. Opening more restaurants doesn't create more market space. But so what it does, essentially, it drives off weaker operators. So unless you keep evolving and improving on your operation, eventually you'll be one of those forced out, I assume.
Particularly where we're areas where there's sort of food markets and you know, street markets, that in fact people are not going to the pub because they're not sure how long it's going to take. That's the issue with pubs, because they sort of really worry that it's going to take them too long. They just nip down the road and they buy their lunchbox for a fiver. You might get just as good a lunch offer, if not a better lunch offer, in the pub, but they feel that everything's going to take too long, so therefore they want to get things quick.
It's too much of an experience.
Well, I think you know, business life has speeded. You know, what 20 years ago we didn't have, I mean, we obviously we're all in 24-hour-a-day operations, but typical businesses didn't run 24 hours a day. But with the advent of email, every businessman is operating 24 hours a day, and what it's done, it's filled every waking moment, and so speed at lunchtime is really, you know, I think it's absolutely critical. And we all do it ourselves. You know, we'll probably leave here, and instead of going into a restaurant, we're going to grab a.
I've already done that today. I had it before I came here. Just so. Wasn't sure what
because you heard the lobster was off. Yeah.
No, but it's true, you know. And
but you know that speed of and nobody wants to drink a load of glasses of wine at lunchtime anymore unless you're really celebrating. I mean, it's unusual, isn't it?
Yeah, very, very unusual.
And it's changed. It's changed a lot.
How important is it to be on kind of nodding terms with the employees, down in the trenches, knowing them by first names, or do you all stay in the upper echelons of the management structure?
Well, I can only speak for myself, but if I did that, I certainly wouldn't have many staff. No. So I think it's, look, I don't know everybody's name.
Sure.
I accept that, but I know everybody to be able to say good morning to talk to. And I think it's very important that I'm at that level. And if it, if there's a loo blocked and I'm the only guy around, then I'm afraid it's going to be me to sort it out. I try not to do that too often.
Right, okay.
But generally, I think it's really important that, I treat them, they treat me, and I treat them as in the same way. So, I've got to be down there at the trenches talking to them, and they've got to understand what my vision is and where I want the business to go. Otherwise, I think you don't get buy-in.
Absolutely.
I think that must be true of any operator that's successful. I'm a big believer that the most important person in my business is my employee.
Yeah.
Without good staff, I can't get the consistent service. I can't get the consistently good food. And in terms of working amongst them, actually, it's a bit of an issue. I actually get my senior management saying, look, can you sort of take a step back and stop getting so involved? Because it makes our jobs much harder when they go around us. So I actually try to stay a little bit more away because I love being around them and I really appreciate all the staff. It always surprises me where an employer doesn't respect their staff. These guys are giving up their lives. Mm. They could be anywhere. They can work anywhere they want,
course,
especially in this industry that's so hard to get good people. So, to the fact that they're there and they're making money for me, I mean, they make an income, but, they're there supporting my dream, and it's really important that we recognize that and take care of them and make them feel appreciated and rewarded for the effort they make. And retaining them, I mean, we all know what the benefits is to retain people that you've spent so much money and time training to work in a certain way, to fulfill the jobs that we require, and then to go and work for someone else. I'm sick and tired of seeing managers trained up to manage other people's businesses.
Absolutely.
So, it's really hard to keep staff because the demand is so high. I mean, we've got restaurants opening left, right and center, throwing money at staff. So what we can only do is pay as much as we can afford to pay,
absolutely,
but make their conditions so good that the money maybe isn't as important as their happiness.
For me, the only restriction to developing successful hospitality businesses is if you work hard enough, you find a property.
Mm-hmm.
If you work hard enough, you can find the cash.
Yeah.
The cash is never, people talk about this lack of availability. I don't actually believe that. If the idea is good enough.
It's actually quite the opposite. You can get money easily. Yeah. Finding the right partners hard.
Okay. But the only limitation is people.
Yeah.
And, at all levels. And so we've just been talking about some of the rank and file, but actually, you mentioned sort of developing your own management teams and them growing with you and allowing you to grow further. That's the limitation. And, if somebody handed me 10 properties tomorrow, I wouldn't open them because I don't have anything like that number of people to do a good job of operating them.
Absolutely. So how much do each of you get involved in that experience on a very micro level? Are you in there choosing the pillows and the paintings on the walls, Rupert, or do you leave that to someone else?
I don't have any pillows, unfortunately. I'd love a few bedrooms in our pubs, but we don't have any in London. But as I work with my wife, I sleep with my wife, and I live with my wife, and she's involved in all of our design. Therefore, I get very involved,
right,
from head to toe, from soup to nuts, and so that's absolutely key. Obviously, at the end of the day, she has a very firm opinion, but so do we both. And I guess there'll probably be more arguments in the Cleveley household surrounding design than anything else.
Okay.
So yeah, completely involved.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very similar setup, to be absolutely honest. Judy and I work together. I don't know how many hotels we've designed together now, a few, and you know, but we still, you know, for instance, we use vintage cutlery and china at the moment. We literally go to junk shops and choose the individual pieces of cutlery. You know, so, and we're serving, I don't know how many thousand covers a day now, you know, but it's that important. Yeah. And sometimes it's really, really difficult to, delegate those details. I mean, I have always said about this business, you know, it really isn't that, you know, it's not earth-shattering what we do, but it is about a million details. And if you know, the more of those million details you get right, then the more likely you to be successful.
The difficulty is to repeat a second restaurant, you know, so we have Giotto, and now I can leave it to a lot of other people to get that done. But when it comes to the very first and the very unique experience that we're creating and design and every aspect, you know, I walk the restaurant 100 times before it's even been built, and I've served every customer personally in my mind's eye, and I've seen everything the way it needs to be done, and sleepless nights and nightmares. Yeah. You know, bedtime is a nightmare for me. I have to try to, you know, all sorts of things to get to sleep because the mind doesn't stop racing. But trying to put that picture into words is very hard.
Sure.
And trying to relay that is very hard. So the only way to do it is really to do it yourself. First, the first time it's me, and the second time it will be the team that have come together to learn how it is that I want things done. And it is a very personal thing, and I tried the program of letting everyone have an idea, and I realized nothing gets done and everyone has a different opinion, and ultimately I just want it to be mine anyway, so
right.
I've decided I just do it, and then everyone else can just get on board.
I've never been in these guys' bedrooms, but yeah, I guarantee that we all have the same pad by the side by the side of our bed that you wake up in the middle of the night and think about something and write it down.
Actually, Giotto Mate, I woke up one morning at about 4 in the morning and I wrote for about 2-3 hours all the details.
Wow.
It was just flowing through my mind. I was like, this has got to happen.
Do you find yourself after you wrote one thinking, I'm never going to do that again, that was too stressful? Or was it always kind of an addict's reliance on the next hit?
I'm going to jump in. I know I'm talking. But I tell you what, the way I can describe this, I hate the experience. I hate it.
Okay.
It opens and then it works and then I love it, you know, and then you get a bit bored and you want to do it again. I would put it as, and I've never done it because I'm too afraid to do it, is getting on a plane and jumping out with a parachute. It would be terrifying through the whole process until you're safely on the ground again and you think, I want to do that again. And that's what I imagine the fear and the satisfaction is like for me when I open a restaurant. I, not knowing whether it's going to work, all the headaches that you have during the build and the staffing and the train, la, 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 and then it works. And you think, yeah, I want to do this again.
It's like Hospitality Anonymous, isn't it? Yeah.
Well, I'm glad we can provide some therapy for you. And Rupert, you've invested in other people's businesses and help open them, I suppose. You mentioned Pizza Pilgrims before, and I'm aware you do Pops, which is kind of a champagne ice lolly. So how do you know a good idea when you see it from someone else, and what do you look for?
I think it's a bit seat of the pants. It's what I feel is right. And if I look at the Pops idea, I remember going to a party and I saw these champagne ice lollies and I thought they were very interesting. I enjoyed them, thought there are a few things that I would want to change if I was involved. But then when I sat down with the boys and found out a bit more about them, I was really impressed with the two people. So, yes, you can see the idea's got to be good, but at the end of the day, you back people and you support people. And Charles and James, Charlie and James, who created it, are just two extraordinary young men who built something from nothing. It's just a fun idea that they had at college or at uni. And suddenly today they've got a lovely, beautiful little brand that, for example, last month they sold 150,000 pops in Melbourne. Yeah. You know, that's amazing stuff. So it's fun. And with Pizza Pilgrims, I happened to our original business partner in Geronimo was a guy called Nick Elliott, who I think you knew. Mm-hmm. Nick, and Nick's had two boys, James and Tom. One was our page boy and one was my godson. Nick sadly died and we always said we'd support them. They came up with this idea of Pizza Pilgrims and it's just been amazing.
Yeah,
and it's really going well. We've got 5 new sites we're opening in the next 12 months, so it's very enjoyable. All I can do with those guys is to help channel them. I'm not there to give them the ideas, just to help channel them and help them prevent them from making the same mistakes that I've done for the last 59 years.
And looking forward, to maybe new children, new projects. We seem to have had every kind of cuisine under the sun in London and England at the moment, and there's no corner of the world that hasn't been tapped for its food.
Is there
anything? Well, that's my question then.
I don't know what the next trend will be. I always try to find something new though, because the last three restaurants are completely different to each other, and the next one will be too if I do anything else in London. But people are traveling so much, and we're always looking for the next thing. So generally, what I'm seeing is that the customers, and like the millennials, if we talk about them, the sort of ones that are sort of traveling now through eating food. So they go to restaurants that are different, that they haven't tried this cuisine before, because in a way, it's for them is a way to travel. So I think as operators, we're always looking for the next thing. And I don't think the Latin American, the South American food has been done properly here. We've seen probably the worst side of it, because that's the taco, the nacho. And that's never really worked in London before. I remember Taco Bell being in London and going again, whereas in America it's this huge success. London wasn't ready for the taco. And then Chilango, Chipotle, and all these other types of burrito type places have come, and they're doing very well. But I think really good South American Latin kitchen doing really fine dining, because if you look at the top 50 restaurants of the world, there's a few that have come up in South America, and then they have the top 50 restaurants of Latin America. Yeah. And just reading about these restaurants, I think someone should be doing that. If I don't do it, someone should, and right. I want to, but I don't know whether I will. But I think that sort of side of the world hasn't really been explored properly yet.
I think whatever we do, we've got a very experienced public out there now. They've all been everywhere. They've all seen everything. And they can see through a hollow concept, right, just like that, you know. So whatever we do, and, you know, restaurants and hotels, they need stories in order to get your head above a parapet. But the story has to be completely and utterly genuine through to the core, so that it's not just some shallow sign over the door and there's nothing behind it. So whatever that is, so whether it's a South American restaurant or whatever, you know, it can't just be, you know, somebody in the West End rattling off a menu and calling it, you know, it has to have some genuine roots to it, you know.
Do you have to have a very thick skin then, Robin, if you're working in hospitality?
Yeah, I think, I think you do, and arguably, I think with hotels, you know, those same customers might spend 24 hours or longer in the hotel, so it's actually... But they look at more stuff, and there's more things to get wrong. You know, there's probably, you know, there might be, you know, several hundred tiny little interactions between
that
customer,
and
different members of staff, and so on. So there's plenty to go wrong, and believe me, we get it wrong plenty. I think, you know, I always care. You know, I mean, it is a wound to the is a stab wound to the heart when someone complains, and you know you've screwed it up or whatever. I think there are ways of complaining, and there are good and bad customers for that. And let's face it, if you are determined to have a horrible time somewhere, you can definitely have a horrible time.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you can find things that don't suit you. But I think for us, the vast majority of guests are pretty good. We all love the opportunity, if there's something that we've done wrong, to have the opportunity to sort it out there and then. Of course, we'd much rather that than them go off disgruntled and tell a load of other people, or write on, you know, some website or whatever, you know. So,
the relief for me, everyone tells me, and I believe it's true, is that no one really reads these reviews and takes them as a true depiction of what the offer is. And a lot of the time, these reviews, I've been told, just more for fun, you know, to read, you know, how scathing these reviews could be or whatever, you know, I don't know. But, they say that all news is, all press is good, right? I don't even know the saying, but you know the saying. All news is, it helps anyway to get recognition.
So if I was to start up a restaurant this year, 2017, as a young entrepreneur, what one piece of advice would you each give me, if you could, put it in a single point, Rupert?
God, I have no idea. That's a very. I might let somebody else go first, actually. Okay. I'll talk about restaurants. Go on.
I would say, go and work in a restaurant and put in some serious hours and run around the floor and understand what the hell goes on before you try and put any money in it yourself.
Okay.
Well, failing that, because, and that's absolutely the best advice. Don't do it unless you know what you're doing. Everyone thinks they know how to do something else, and they leave their professions to try something. But if you don't know, get someone who does.
Yeah.
Because, all too often you see these people opening restaurants and you think, oh, what are they doing? Yeah. And they have no experience, but they have lots of money, so they throw the money at the problem, but it doesn't fix it.
Yeah, I think that. Thanks, guys. You've helped me a lot there. But I think that would be, for me, that would be the right thing. If I look at the Pizza Pilgrims boys, I think having a team of people around them who've done it before has been a massive benefit to them. Yeah. They've been the creative thing. They've done everything, but they have had that massive support.
And you know why we talked about this earlier? Because it's so much harder today.
Yeah.
Before, you might be forgiven if it wasn't right. Before, you'd be forgiven if the food wasn't where it should be, and you'd have time to get it right. But today, it's like one hit. You don't get it right, they walk through the doors, you're written off because there's another place that opened doing it right.
Yeah.
I think the other thing is as well that for I'm sure we all get asked by different businesses to help them or cast an eye over something. And actually, they need to prove it on paper as well as, just coming up with some wacky idea, So, and all of a sudden they sit down and say, you mean we can't afford to pay the chef 80 grand and we've got to serve, 50 cups of tea before we've paid for turning the lights on and all that sort of thing. So, it's a bit of a shock to the system when you break it down step by step and realise what you really have to do to cover your overheads, And I always say to them, work it out on paper, come and show me the piece of paper and then we'll talk about it.
If they can't get that right, they shouldn't start, to be honest.
Because it is fascinating, the costs that go into your P&L. I just looked at ours for Christmas this morning. It's just
I thought
all
you were looking
thing.
A bit miserable.
No, I'm very happy. But I was just looking at all the different lines. You just think, holy my God, there's so many different things, so many different facets that go through. Yeah. And people have got most young people have got no idea.
Well, you succeeded in putting me off that, at least. But what are your own business
we
goals?
Don't want any more competition.
No, I can imagine. But do you have any? What's up the sleeve for each of you, Robin? Have you got anything in the irons on fire?
We're working on a couple of sites in the pipeline. So more pigs. Yeah. It's been incredibly the concept has been incredibly successful for us, and we opened. A hotel a little further afield from London this past year in Devon, which rocks along like it's in Knightsbridge, which is sort of amazing. It's quite a lot, it's in the middle of nowhere. So that's given us perhaps new courage to do other things. But we certainly see a couple more in the pipeline. Whether we get them off the blocks this year or it'll be next year, I don't know. But
okay. Kurt, what's up the sleeve? Well,
the most imminent thing to happen will be this month. I'm opening the organic bakery, deli, panetteria.
Yeah.
It's a spin-off
Where
of Fucina.
That?
It's on Paddington Street in Marylebone, just on the corner of Fucina. Two doors down, I took a bakery. Well, we have a bakery, so that opens in January. And then the big two things really are Miami and Toronto. July, August will be Miami, and September, October will be... Toronto. They're falling very close together because one came together quicker and the other one was delayed, so now they're being brought together.
Where are you in Miami?
And Lincoln Road down South Beach, Miami, in the new development there by the 1111 car park. So at the bottom you've got Juvia. Do you know Juvia? And so we're just down there. And in Toronto we're on the corner of Bay and Front Street by Union Station. It's the busiest corner in Toronto apparently, so...
So are you
Canada,
sleeping?
Actually.
You sleeping well at the moment with those?
No. These bags under my eyes weren't there before.
No, not at all. And Rupert, have we got anything?
We've got two or three more pubs we're working on at the moment. So my wife's pretty busy and we've got exciting times with Pizza Pilgrims and raising a bit of cash for the boys in Pop. So it's a very exciting year ahead. Looking forward to it.
Very good. Well, that seems like a nice... note as any to end on. So thank you all very, very much for coming in. And it's been absolutely fascinating. I'm sure our readers will be thrilled to hear all your insights and all your stories. So thanks very much, chaps.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very, very much for listening to this episode of the Gentleman's Journal podcast. We'll be back in a fortnight with more invaluable insights from the world of entrepreneurs. But until then, you can find us on our website, which is www.thegentlemansjournal.com. Or if you're so inclined, follow us on Instagram at The Gents Journal, or indeed on Twitter at The Gents Journal. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you very, very soon.